We're on a mission to explore how emerging technologies, media, robotics, and data and behavioral science will solve humanity's most pressing challenges. From education, mobility, energy, food and water supplies, the environment, employment, all the way to disease and basic human rights. Nothing is off limits. This episode is brought to you by Beverage Universe. They have every flavor to help you stay young, beautiful, and thirsty. Go to beverageuniverse.com for your next flavor experience. So I'm excited to introduce our guest today, Arjun Rai. Arjun is the founder and CEO of Hello Woofy, woofy.ai, and emojidata.ai. Welcome, Arjun.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for sharing your experiences and your knowledge with us today. So I wanted to start off with some information, and if you could tell us a bit about your background and how did you get started in this whole entrepreneurial journey that you're on?
Sure. Great question. So my mom would tell you that, or my dad as well, and that I've been selling something or the other since I was 7, 8 years of age, from selling, flowers at a wedding that were used, as you know, Indian weddings have a lot of flowers. So I just picked them up and turned them into garlands and, tried reselling them at my grandmother's gate. And my mom was like, why are you selling them for a quarter? And of course, we're in India right now because we were just visiting India. And there's like, no one knows what a quarter is in India. And first of all, why are you selling so low? And second of all, why are you selling it at all? And so I got in trouble there. And then, I remember a couple of years earlier or later, it's a little fuzzy right now, but we were moving out of a apartment in Colorado. And, there was a whole bunch of furniture we were getting ready to throw out. And, we were also up against a very busy road. And so I had this, maybe a 2 foot by 3 feet paper that said 25 cents, all furniture must go. And people started coming up as the movers were trying to get down and, take the stuff out. And my mom sees this on her way back because she went to grab food. And she's like, what the heck are you doing? Again, 25 cents. So something with a quarter was very fascinating to me. So again, got in trouble there. But fast forward, when I was a teenager in high school, I decided to team up with a couple of people, build an ad network, which did pretty well. And then, we learned quickly that, we were probably too naive. And there was so much more to learn about raising capital, about business development, things like that. But it was a good early MBA. How to bring people to the board, how to get advisors and mentors on board, how to put an investor deck together. So all of those things I definitely think I learned pretty quickly and at a very young age. And then following that, ended up convincing the dean at the university I ended up applying to that, I was worth backing from an education standpoint. And so he ended up giving me a couple of scholarships, which pretty much, gave me a full ride for the first year. Came to New York and launched this ad agency focused on social media marketing, just so I could pay the bills and make sure that I could feed myself and do all the other things I wanted to do in New York. And by way of that, figured out that project management sucked for creative individuals, and so I ended up raising about a little under 100K from some very notable investors like Brian Cohen, first investor in Pinterest, Jeff Pulver, one of the first guys in Twitter and Facebook. So these people were like, we want to support you and we want to back you. And so they wrote small checks. And, that was gratifying. And that was my first way into the angel and the venture community itself. And then by the end of college, I ended up getting a few more years of scholarships that helped pay for college. And at the same time, I was running another business that, was for project management. We ended up raising another about 850, 900K. So in aggregate, about $1 million. By way of running that company, we've quickly figured out that, sometimes a deal may be too sweet and too good to, too good to be real. And so I learned quickly to, always do due diligence, when you're looking at a deal, whether you're raising capital or you're doing, business development or getting a new client. And so I didn't have that knowledge or that know-how back then, but learned very quickly that that's important. So a couple of years later, we ended up having to shut down the company. We ran out of cash. We were way too early for our own good. We were betting that you know, project management would be more easier on bigger touchscreen devices and they would get cheaper, which they did. The Surface Pro, the iPad Pro came out, but just the timing didn't match up. So that was my first venture failure, and I learned, you know, where timing is very important. Getting the right people on board is very important, whether it's the engineers or even the investors. And then following that, that's what we were referring to as my current position, is building a social media platform that allows anyone and everyone around the world to essentially take back their time, the grunt work that goes into social media marketing, and do it based on data, not just, you know, because they feel like winging it, but they feel like that they can actually make informed decisions and compete with companies that have pretty much unlimited marketing budgets. And so mm-hmm. we're looking to level the playing field on multiple levels when it comes to marketing.
Mm-hmm. So before Hello Woofy, so you were you born in New Jersey?
No, I was born in New Delhi, and so I moved to Chicago when I was 4 or 5 years of age. And then because my dad was in IT, he would get new positions in at work every 6 to 12 months. So we moved around a lot. We were in Chicago and Colorado. We were in California, back in Chicago, and then finally, most of my education I ended up doing in New Jersey, between West Windsor and Plainsboro, New Jersey.
And you mentioned in college, yeah. Or actually all the way back into high school, you had already started developing a product.
Yeah, it was an ad network, and I was playing around with different languages, programming languages. I had actually started programming in seventh grade. That was
what language?
There was basic ones like HTML, CSS, just getting, you know, getting into Visual Basic and JavaScript. But I think my passion really came out in the front-end development, which was all about design, aesthetics, and how, you know, the UX is very critical to, you know, making sure the customer feels, you know, like they can actually get something out of the product. So I guess that was my first, you know, foray into the product development side of things, and use those skills to make MVPs and wireframes and raise cap, you know, funding off of that.
And then into college, you started your first agency per se. What made you think that was a good direction to kind of look into?
So one thing led to the other. In high school, I was very fascinated by the radio class and the radio club overall. And so I ended up joining that early on, and copywriting and headline writing and, you know, just interviewing people kind of came almost as a natural thing to me. So I ended up using that experience and saying, okay, let me do social media marketing and take this conversational aspect and, you know, help companies and startups mostly at that time. Talk better on social media. So I started freelancing actually before I went to college, but then I was, you know, basically thinking about how do I formalize this and sort of turn that into an agency. And so I've always been in communications one way or the other, and running my own agency, figuring out what are the pain points of running an agency, which in that case was project management. There was no visual way to, you know, manage people and projects.
Still is.
Yeah. And ended up, you know, building that into a venture-backed idea.
And then after that, your first venture-backed idea after the agency was, you mentioned, Workbench, correct?
Yeah, it was formerly known as Canvas, and we had a, you know, trademark issue with a company out in England, so we ended up renaming it to Workbench.
So tell me a bit about that. How did you kind of venture out of agency life and start creating products?
It almost came as a need. I needed a better project management solution because we were working with people offshore, onshore, people around the world. And if you tried using existing tools like Asana or Microsoft Project, it almost felt like if you were a chef at a marquee restaurant and you were given a series of blunt knives and expected to run the restaurant really efficiently, it wouldn't happen, right? Mm-hmm. You'd be not only inefficient, but you'd be very disgruntled.
And injured.
And you'd always be pushed to the max to make sure that you're hitting the bottom line. So same thing in agencies, or in my own agency. It always felt like we were trying to do better with, and, you know, ways that didn't keep up with the changing of the time. And so we were looking for tools that could allow us to, basically render our desk. Right. If you had, you know, projects on your desk, you had people you want to work with, you had, you know, documents you want to work with, you would just shuffle them around and, you know, put people together and say that you do a project, you know, drag a project to, or drag a document to a person and say, this is, I'm sending it to you, it might be a brief, take a look at it, sign off on it, and then send it back to a client. So it's a very visual way of thinking and approaching things on tabletop. We were saying, why can't you do that as a project manager? And there was a company earlier on called BumpTop that was a huge inspiration. The founder was very much ahead of his time. He ended up selling that company to Google. But the technology back then definitely was not where we were. We needed the technology to be. And we said, why don't we actually try building it now and make it more visual? But unfortunately, as I said before, we still weren't there from a hardware standpoint. Touchscreens weren't as cheap as possible. And touch projectors were still not available as widely.
Mm-hmm. So then after Workbench, you started Hello Woofy.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about that. How did you make that jump from Workbench into Hello Woofy?
So following, very painfully shutting down the company because, we were running out of cash and we basically said this is too early, too early for its own good. We basically said that, we need to find an idea that is still a pain point in the creative space, especially from a communication standpoint. And very naturally, social media marketing came back to me. And I can remember running Workbench as a engineer, but doing all the non-engineer stuff, which is obviously accounting and marketing and sales and customer development. The customer marketing and sales side really resonated with me because there was no way to scale it. And when it came to talking to customers online or talking to customers in person, it was always about the communication aspect. And so even when I was running the agency, we used tools like Hootsuite and Buffer to schedule content for our clients. It wasn't very scalable. And even if it was scalable, it wasn't very creative in nature. So we basically decided to build something. It was a mobile app originally. We had about 10,000 downloads when we launched about 2-3 years ago. And almost everyone that looked at the product said it was definitely more visual. It was definitely more powerful than any of our competitors, but they wanted a bigger screen size. So in terms of learning, you have to talk to your customers all the time, even if it's very, very early on. So we ended up raising a little bit more capital based off the prototype that was in mobile app. We then got into an accelerator program here in New York, and we basically pivoted.
Which one?
Quite Capital. Mm-hmm. And we essentially decided to pivot to a desktop-oriented ecosystem for the product itself. And if we hadn't listened to our customers, we would have continued building the mobile app to no end and saying that this is what we need and this is what we think the customer needs, which is not true. If you actually talk to the customer, you'll get very different opinions. So we ended up, long story short, we built a data science-driven marketing platform for the web. And that's where we are today. It's entirely data science driven, and every part of the platform is based on data. It's not about winging it or what a copywriter may feel like, typing in. Everything is all about data.
So let's talk about that pivot from one product to the current Hello Woofy product.
Yep.
You basically had to restructure everything from the ground up. You had to get refunded. You had to repitch. You had to get into an accelerator program. Let's talk about that. How did you go about, number one, building a new team?
Yep.
And then number two, getting funded?
So originally, the first series of checks that came in actually came in from a fund called 1517 Fund. And they're most notably known for having the founders come from the Thiel Fellowship. So one of the partners was actually following me since I was 19. And he reached out to me when I was 19, and we finally spoke when I was 20, which was 3 weeks later. That was my birthday. And I was disqualified because back then the Thiel Fellowship said, if you're over 20, you're disqualified. They're looking for candidates under 20. And then subsequently since then, they, I think, upped it to 25. And so we stayed in touch, and one thing led to the other. We were at Next Gen Summit, and I met the same guy and his partner, Danielle. And a couple of months later, they ended up writing a check, and they said, this is interesting. We had 10,000 downloads at that point, and let's see what you can do. And, of course, to your other point, we ended up getting into Accelerator. They upped their investment by another 100K. And overall, we had raised just a little bit over 250K. This was November of 2017, and so learned a lot from that experience overall. But one of the things that I think we had to do as a difficult choice was let go of our co-founder. So a couple of months later, we had a falling out. There were certain things that were not above water. that, you know, I came to know of. And we essentially decided to let go of him, a couple of other people as well who were part of that disarray. And we had about $12,000 left in the bank. I told my investors that this is where we are. We hired the wrong engineer. We obviously had the wrong co-founder. You know, what do we do? And all of our investors said, don't worry about it. You know, we'll invest in the next thing you do. And if you're going to shut it down, that's totally fine. So it's one of those moments where you learn about people and how important it is to have the right people around you, and not people who are too greedy or always looking for the bottom line. And I told them, I turned around and told them that I'll do whatever it takes to make sure the company survives, that we ship product, we build product, and make revenue, and you know, make sure that this is, we'll get you your money back. Fast forward a couple of months, I ended up picking up a job as a chief of staff at a startup, basically plowing all of my salary into the company itself to the tune of about $170K to date. That's obviously the salary, the, you know, credit cards, credit line, you know, savings, all of it into the company. And, you know, fast forward a couple of months, we ended up shipping product, generating revenue. You know, we were just on a TV show as well, which I can't talk about too much. you know, pitching some incredible investors. And there's some other news coming out in the next couple of weeks as well, which I'm very excited about. I think that's almost like the stamp of approval from the universe that you did it and you stuck with it and you didn't let it die. Mainly because we still feel the need is, you know, there's a need for it for every business owner around the world to compete in marketing. And so now we can allow them to do that.
So when you approached investors, mm-hmm. how did you pitch the idea? What was your kind of like your star statement?
Originally, I would always say it's this for that. Like, you know, it was originally, we would say it's Hootsuite on steroids, or it's, you know, Hootsuite but on mobile, or Buffer on mobile but more intelligent. Designed for people on the go, you know, when they're in the Uber or in the Lyft, they're looking to run their marketing campaigns and then check on them and then, you know, be off on their way. And that kind of resonated with influencers who said, obviously, you know, we're always on the go. We don't have a big team and we need a tool that can take away a lot of the grunt work. But more so than that, it became clear that people wanted a bigger real estate in terms of, you know, web platform. And so we pivoted because of that. And investors liked the fact that we were talking to customers and we weren't just making product internally and wishing that this would work. We were definitely bringing customers. In fact, we were videotaping and, you know, with their approval and permission to show investors that this is what our customers are saying, this is what they want, and this is the pain point that we are looking to solve. And they understood that, you know, this isn't a company or group of people who are just building product just for the sake of building product. Because that's, I think, something that's very common in startup world, is you get into this everlasting loop of just building product and wasting money. And I think that was something that the investors early on saw. And even through the accelerator program, we were trying to build product. We obviously had the wrong engineer on board. But even with that mistake, we learned how not to build a product. And when we eventually did build the right kind of product, all of the learning that went into it wasn't just about what the customers said, but what didn't work out in the last couple of months before that. And so we had a really polished product at that point.
So that's it's a good point. So let's talk about how not to build a product.
Yeah. Fact check everything that a person might say in terms of their resume. We quickly figured out that, you know, resume is one thing, an interview is another thing, and if you get a referral from someone who you trust, that's another thing. In terms of, you need to check all of those avenues of due diligence and make sure that you did your own due diligence and you're not banking on someone else doing their part. So very quickly we actually were recommended the engineer, the CTO, from our investor and a junior partner at the fund. And, you know, obviously we went in blindly and said, of course, you know, great friend, great, you know, referral, we should go ahead and hire the person. We did, and we quickly figured out that, you know, the person was taking code from, you know, all over the internet, you know, open sourced code files, and, you know, slicing and dicing it together and, you know, slapping on an MIT license on it, which I don't know if you know or your viewers know. But MIT license basically says at the core of it that it's not that the company doesn't own the IP. It means that anyone who has access to the source code also can say they own the IP. So, I mean, April of April of 2018, I basically said that, you know, this is not good at all. We had wasted so much money into building the product at that point and salaries and everything that we need to fully stop this. We need to let go of the CTO. And a couple of weeks later, I ended up having to let go of my co-founder as well. And that was an interesting point in history in terms of learning how to let go of a close friend, but then also how to say no more to you know, what is perpetually basically a really disease in the culture itself. And at that point, we had $12,000 left in the bank, and we basically decided to do a turnaround. We scrapped everything. We found a new team offshore. We built product in under a year. We shipped it. We had beta clients, and today we have a really good number of clients on board in just a matter of 8 weeks of launching.
Hmm. Congratulations.
Yep.
That is quite a bit of an achievement.
Yep. Yep. But there's a lot of, you know, blood, sweat, and tears that goes into it. I remember, you know, after my day job as a chief of staff, you know, coming back home from 7 to 12 o'clock working on the company, and then in the morning 5 to like 7:30 in the morning working on the company, and then going to work, and then coming back and doing the same thing over and over again. Because our team was based in, you know, Europe, and our data science team was based in Asia. And so we were working, or, you know, pretty much me, I was working around the clock. And I think that's, you just have to have a certain mentality to just keep going no matter what. And of course, your health might take a toll, but I think we were definitely looking for the long term.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty typical kind of entrepreneur story where, you know, right now it's glamorized and everybody, yeah, you know, thinks that it's so cool to be an entrepreneur when in essence it's one of the most stressful things that you could, yeah, possibly imagine. And, you know, you give everything up for it.
I had this quote in my office at the university, which, you know, NYT was very generous to give me an incubator space within the university itself and help, you know, allow me to help run it as well. And I remember one quote on the wall that said, "For every 2 minutes of fame, there are 8 hours of hard work."
Right.
And so even being on your show, I mean, you know, the fact that we were at DMWF and we met there, and, you know, we haven't talked about the amount of time that went into negotiating that deal to be at DMWF, and then, you know, just everything has a story, but it's, to your point, it's glamorized on the face of it.
Let's take a quick break and thank our sponsors. The production of the Amplified podcast has been brought to you by Social Fix Media. Social Fix is a transformational growth hacker agency focused on emerging technology platforms, video and podcast production, content marketing, and overall startup strategy. Social Fix has helped over 300 clients generate millions of dollars in revenue, fundraising, and profit. If you'd like help launching or growing your business, visit socialfix.com. Let's
talk about some of the common, I think, mistakes that happen, mm-hmm, when launching a product. Like, for example, yep, mispricing. How did you determine how to price your platform? So, for example, is it per seat? Is it per license? Is it per team? Per channel?
Yep. So originally it was basically a user base. So it was one user who could manage X number of social media accounts. And we started with that as an iOS app. And we quickly figured out that our price point was extremely low. We were charging anywhere from, I think, $5 to $15 a month in different tiers. And we really wanted to make sure that a lot more people bought into it and could give us feedback and, you know, basically, you know, have a better chance of getting a wider spread of opinions so that we could build on the product. And that turned out to be a bad decision. We made the product so cheap that the audience that was coming after it wasn't the ideal audience that our customer base we were looking for originally. And almost every customer that we wanted to go after said that we'd be willing to pay anywhere from, you know, five times or maybe, you know, or more than the price point you have already. And so I think pricing is very key from the get-go. And so when we launched about a couple of weeks ago, we were running a short, you know, promotion essentially for pre-orders, where we were giving the product away for, you know, very low pricing. But eventually when we went to market, we wanted to stick to $49 a month. And we didn't have any issues with that because we were at, you know, on par with our closest competitor at $49 a month, and we were $20 more premium than our biggest competitor. And in both situations, they couldn't come close to any of the data science or the technology that we had built. And so we felt, you know, we should stick by our guns on that. And I think sometimes entrepreneurs make the mistake of making things too cheap and expecting customers to be okay with it. But if you actually have a premium pricing and then you have room to give discounts, depending on the contract, depending on the customer, then you have a lot more wiggle room, because at $5, you don't have a lot of wiggle room to give discounts. I mean, your 50% discount, which probably the most you want to give, is $2.50, which is about a Subway ride. And so that, you know, you have to be very careful about what tone you set in the market with your pricing from the get-go.
Another common mistake that happens when launching a product is not having your customers' trust. Mm-hmm. So how did you overcome that? Just based on what the what other competitors are out there.
It's a great question. We were very much getting customers organically through Facebook groups, through personal introductions, things of that nature, and so we were building trust when I was scheduling the call itself, and they could see me face to face, and see that there's a founder behind the company who's working really hard to solve a problem that they may or may not have, because obviously at that point we had just started talking. And by the end of the call, they understand that, of course, you're a founder, you're building, a product for them, and that they will, give you a credit card, give you their credit card information. They'll give you, the ability to win their trust at that point. And so we have obviously said, give us 2 months, 3 months. The pre-orders are running right now. Stick with us, and we'll give you a massive discount. But most of all, thank you for your time, and thank you for your feedback, because that's all going into the product, which you're about to use in 30, 60, 90 days. And at that point, they were like, this is a no-brainer, because the pricing is affordable. I'm locked in for the next 1 or 2 years, depending on which tier they had bought into. And they're getting to see the person behind it. It's not like, there's a chat bot, or there's a, support ticket being opened on email, or, this is an email-based conversation. You have a human-to-human element in that conversation. So many times I was talking to agency founders who had a dozen clients, some who had just started in social media marketing, or some people who had, sold multiple agencies before, and they were looking for their next solution to help, further their own business in the marketing space. But you have to get on a phone call with them, and video calls are the best, so that you can see each other.
Mm-hmm. I agree. How about looking at the competitor space? That's one of the third common mistakes that happen, is that a lot of times product companies will kind of prematurely dismiss their competitors.
Yep.
How did you guys go about looking at that space and deciding whether this product belonged at this time on the market?
I think one of the mistakes that especially new entrepreneurs make is that they almost disrespect the competition. If you're a hunter, or if you talk to anyone who's a hunter or even a soldier, you have to learn to respect the enemy, because or what can kill you, because if you don't, then you'll disregard it, and it may to the point where you might let it take advantage of you. So in our case, we always say, we're highly respectful of the companies that are around that have come, years to decades before us, and there's a lot to learn from them. Even the founders, we happen to know some of the founders of our competitors, and, over the years we've gotten to know them better, or through our, advisory group and investor group, we've been able to get to know them as well. And at the core of it, if you respect them, then you know what your baseline is also, because you then understand from a product offering standpoint, this is the bottom, this is point A of where they can offer, and you have to obviously be not an incremental improvement, but a massive improvement. So if you completely ignore your competition, then you don't even know what you're competing against and how to improve upon it. And then secondly, once you do know what you're competing against, you have to make sure that you can blow them away in terms of a comparison chart. I always like to say, like Tesla, if you talk to Elon, he won't say he's a car company, he's an energy company. Everything he does, SolarCity, Tesla, or any of the other projects he has, it's all about making sure that everyone has access to energy. In our case, we feel that small agencies, medium agencies, or even entrepreneurs that are getting started, they don't have access to data science. They don't have access to data overall to make better decisions, versus companies like Fortune 500 companies, they have unlimited budgets, unlimited personnel to help them with every part of marketing. And so at the core of what we do is we say we're not a social media company, we're a data science company. So with regards to Woofy.ai or EmojiData.ai, those are projects to make sure that everyone can understand how data science can actually make an improvement in all of the marketing that they do. And so I think that's where we come from.
So let's talk about EmojiData.ai. Yep. And Woofy.ai. Talk to me a bit about that, because, from my knowledge base. I know emojis are a very highly converting type of character for all social posts, whether it's newsletters, social posts themselves, or so forth.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
No, you're absolutely right. Adobe, and I didn't even know this until a couple of months ago, Adobe released an official report called the Adobe Emoji Trend Report in July of 2019. And they said there were multiple points in there, but I think one of my favorite points is 44% of the time when people see an emoji being advertised to them or as a part of a copy that has emojis included, they're 44% of the time more likely to buy. And HubSpot has another article on their blog as well that says a tweet versus another tweet without an emoji, you're able to get 25% uplift in engagement or 57% on Facebook. And so we were like, wow, this is amazing. This is incredible data. Why isn't no one doing any of this? So we then obviously went on Google and we said emoji recommendation or emoji suggestion and things like that nature. And all we could find was basically a drop down of all close to 3,000 emojis. And it's upon you to figure out which ones are relevant and whether you're typing an email, or you're typing a newsletter. I mean, you're going to have to sit through there and, you know, you have to go through a smiley face section, the text section, the flag section. And I was like, why can't this be more programmatic? So long story short, we asked our data scientists to say, basically build a product, an API that's known as emojidata.ai, that essentially allows you to take any string or any text, any marketing speak, and in turn, it turns out contextually relevant emojis. Now, it goes through 35 million data points to figure out what are the best emojis that will do well with the words you've typed in. It could even take emojis as an input and give you other recommendations or emojis that will do well with that. And so we basically built an API that programmatically allows you to do that. And then we basically said, what about other companies? Wouldn't they like to, you know, like email providers and newsletter creation platforms, wouldn't they like to use a platform like this? So, and one of the other parts of the emojidata.ai is that it also helps you complete words. So as you're typing in real time, if I say, I love, and it just type in L-O, it'll complete V-E space Y-O-U automatically, and then it'll start giving you recommendations of hearts and, you know, the smiley face with the kisses coming out. It'll give you all those recommendations in milliseconds. And so we basically said, why don't we actually offer this API to, say, an AOL, you know, or a Microsoft Hotmail provider and allow them to compete with Gmail Smart Compose. Because as you know, in Gmail, as you're typing, it completes the sentences. We could do something similar, but then also offer emojis as a feature that contextually gives you those recommendations. So long story short, that's where emojidata.ai is going. It's an API-based business. But then Woofy, hellowoofy.com is a marketing platform itself, which obviously leverages emojis and autocomplete and a whole bunch of other levels of data science to help marketers.
I needed emojidata.ai a couple weeks ago.
We can talk about that. So we can talk about a potential deal, a licensing deal.
So we were, I'm not going to give out too many details, but we were putting together a newsletter for our client.
Sure.
And I wanted to use emojis because I know it's going to help the open rates.
Yeah.
And I went with all of these different hand gesture emojis. So I had a bunch of them lined up, and you know, we're talking about which one would be a good one. You know, thumbs up, the whatever the sign is. I don't know, the okay sign.
Yep,
the you know, the high five, whatever it was. And then it turned out that these hand gestures meant completely different things in other parts of the world.
So we built a dictionary. Yeah, we built a dictionary internally that kind of prevents that from happening and gives you, like, you know, an understanding of what each sign means. And the other thing you have to keep in mind is that a lot of the iPhone-based emojis are actually not cross-compatible with other platforms, like Windows and Android and whatnot. So they'll actually come out really weird. So we actually only work at Universal Emojis that Unicode, which is the official organization behind text-based communication. And so that kind of prevents that from happening. One of the things I wanted to tell you about in the newsletter side of things is Adobe says that 64% is the engagement rate, or in terms of uplift. We actually found 150% to 180% when we went back in our own newsletters. And I basically said, let me see if this actually works, because I've been using emojis in newsletters for a while, but before that, my co-founder was running the newsletter himself, and he never used emojis. And then I started using emojis, and our our open rate doubled, more than doubled. And I was like, our own data speaks volumes to what Adobe is even finding.
100%. I mean, we see it all the time, and we'll do A/B split tests for the same newsletter running to against the same list, and one will have an emoji in the subject line, one will not. Completely different open rates.
And actually, that's the goal with emoji data, is to allow you to programmatically also run campaigns using the API and see which ones are doing better, which ones are not doing better, and give you a whole slew of data points. We're about to launch an emoji cloud that allows you to see which emojis you tend to use the most and which ones are actually hitting the bottom line. And then on top of that, we're building an emoji ticker in the dashboard itself that shows you across the world which emojis are being used in real time and by popularity. And so there's a lot of emoji science, if that's even a word or a phrase, that's going into it. And you literally cannot find anything on the internet that even comes close, except for a drop-down selector. And so we're double-downing on that in the next couple of weeks.
Very cool. What type of advice would you give people that are currently building a platform?
Talk to your customer with wireframes. That is the furthest you should go before running code. Take a couple of wireframes. If you don't know how to use Illustrator, find someone who knows how to use Illustrator, even if it's a sketch. Go to your customer that you think may be your customer and show them what you're building, and then iterate over the course of a couple of weeks on that wireframe itself or the graphic design. In my case, I loved using Illustrator to wireframe all of the screens and buttons and things like that. You could use something as simple as InVision and have a clickable demo as well. But until you hone in and refine on that idea, don't write a single line of code. And then once you feel more confident, you have maybe a dozen or so people who are giving the okay, that's a great position to be in for letters of intent to then show investors who might be potentially willing to put in money. But that gives you the ability to then go offshore and hire a team for maybe $10,000 or $5,000 and build an MVP, and then come back to the customers and say, okay, here it is. Would you use it? A couple of months later, you're in a position to raise capital.
Very smart. I think that's brilliant. So Arjun, you've done a lot of stuff in your life, and you are a product building machine. Where did this passion come from?
I suppose Legos. I was always fascinated with Legos, and I think there was another company called Mega Bloks back then, but Legos became the popular building block company, and I was always fascinated with just building things. I would also never follow instructions. When you pick out a Lego set and you have the instructions, I would always build my own thing. And I suppose that kind of translated into product or into software design and eventually software products overall and platforms. And again, my earliest memories are building things. Whether it's with sand and having my own construction toys, or Legos, things like that. I've always been a product owner and a product manager, if you will. But obviously, over time, I've pivoted and refined my methodology and made sure that there's a buyer on the other end. Otherwise, I'm just doing it for fun. And I think that's one of the things that I became better as with Woofy, is how do I build product more honed in on the needs and requirements of my customers. And that's when we were able to get a lot more customers in the pipeline. We have 6,000 customers in our pipeline now, potential. And there's a couple of other updates that are coming up in a couple of weeks that I can't talk about right now, but it goes to that same idea, is you have to talk to your customers and get to them as soon as possible.
So tell me, how can our listeners get in touch with you, find you, or maybe even get a demo?
Yeah, absolutely. So hellowoofy.com, which is HelloWoofy.com. And right on there, the first thing you'll see is schedule a demo. And you'll get my personal time, essentially. And you can schedule a 15, 30-minute demo with me, in which case I run you through the product. Then I try to understand what your business needs are. You might be a blog. You might be a sports company. We've talked to so many different kinds of companies that need social media marketing driven by data science. And after following that, we obviously give you a discount code as a thank you for scheduling a call and sitting through that. And you can be up and running. Or you can actually go to our website directly and create a free account, and then upgrade as you see fit.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Amplify Podcast. Follow us on our social channels and subscribe on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. On the next episode, stay tuned for more trailblazing insights, energy, and culture to help fuel your pursuit in the modern digital era.